In the last several talks, Sayadaw has really spoken in a lot of detail about what metta is and how we're best to cultivate it. And today I want to fill in a little bit around the edges, to speak about some things that often here go without saying, but for many of us, we actually need to hear it. To address some essential qualities that support the development of metta and the development of the boundlessness of heart that is loving kindness. The first thing I want to talk about is relaxation, both physical and mental. Because relaxation is essential for the practice. But we need to know, what is this quality of relaxation? What do we mean when we talk about that? So first, the physical relaxation. In the early Buddhist texts, the Buddha gave really specific instructions about posture. He said, in the Satipatthana Sutta, he says, here, gone to a forest, one sits down, and having folded one's legs crosswise, one sets one's body erect. And I want to focus on that last part particularly, because we as Westerners maybe can't sit with crossed legs, and that doesn't matter so much. But the erectness of the body really does matter. In meditation, an upright posture is really important. But we have to understand what erectness means. It shouldn't be a tense kind of straightness where we puff our chest out and sit like soldiers. Especially when we're doing metta bhavana, ease and relaxation need to be there. So we in the West often have the mistaken impression that what relaxation is actually collapse, like that. Like, it's easier to do it than to describe it. And imagine coming home and sitting in one of those cushy chairs and just kind of, ugh. And we think that this kind of postural collapse is actually what relaxation is. But true and deep physical relaxation doesn't come from this kind of postural collapse, because that actually creates quite a lot of tension in places we're not even aware of. True physical relaxation comes when we sit in a posture where the spine is naturally erect, and the spine is actually holding us up. So instead of collapsing downwards and having the spine in a curve like this, which creates a lot of stress on the back and on the neck, sitting in a posture where the spine is upright and the natural curvature of the spine is there, but there isn't the collapse where each vertebra holds the one on top of it up. When we sit with a collapsed posture, it can create back pain, neck pain. It can also constrict the breathing because it constricts the internal space that the diaphragm has to work. And actually, sometimes people that have the tendency to sit like this have a really deep kind of and prolonged chronic oxygen deficit, When you read the scientific literature about posture, it talks about people that have chronic oxygen deficit from not being able to breathe deeply, not being able to use the entirety of their lungs. So this uprightness allows us to fill our chests completely with air. It allows us in the metta bhavana to open the chest. And there's a deeper level to this that I find really, really interesting. Sayadaw spoke yesterday at the beginning of his talk about the power of the mind, about how, you know, just one thought and the body goes somewhere or the arm reaches out. You know, the mind, there's an intention and an action. We go here and there just based on single thoughts. This interaction with body and mind is a two-way street. Just as a single thought can influence physical action, physical posture can influence our emotions. The mind influences the way the body holds itself, of course, but the way the form our body takes triggers and reflects certain states of mind. There's a fellow named Eric Pepper, who's a professor of psychology at San Francisco State University, and he studies this interaction between posture and mood and emotion. And some of his research is really, really interesting, because he did a series of experiments about posture and emotion, and he discovered that when people sit in a kind of collapsed position, they're more likely to feel helpless, to have negative mind states arising, have negative memories arising. Whereas when people sit more upright, that upright position in and of itself is more conducive to positive mind states and positive memories. And it's his hypothesis that there's the current surge of depression is a lot because of the way people work and the way people interact with their devices. You know, we walk around like this, and we sit in front of our computers all curled up. And that posture in and of itself, he thinks, creates a lot of depression and a lot of negative mind states. So in your practice, it's really useful to see how you're sitting, to notice how you're sitting. Are you sitting stiffly, tightly, with your arms kind of jammed in against your sides? I'm going to be erect. That's tension that's unnecessary. And kind of the other end of the spectrum, are you collapsed? Well, the best, most erect posture is the middle way. Middle way always works. And I like to take as my models for good posture Burmese people. Some of you went to Sayadaw's village, to Taleba, last week. And you wouldn't have seen it because they don't have to do it anymore. But once upon a time, until last year, women had to gather water twice a day from the river. And they carried these big clay pots of water on their heads. And some of these women, like Mathwe, the woman in the office, she's very small. And some of these women, they carry these very heavy pots of water on their head. And what that does, because it's always the younger women that do it, and the children too, what that does is it creates and trains them to have really beautiful upright posture. Not stiff with your chest puffed out, but not collapsed either. There's just this beautiful uprightness. Or look at any Buddha Rupa. These are kind of role models, for me anyway, about what good posture and what conducive posture is for the practice. In the meditation center in Yangon, the branch, this is a branch center of that main center, there are cartoons on the wall of the meditation hall saying how you shouldn't sit. And, you know, there's a cartoon of somebody sitting over like this. So even in Burma, this instruction is there, and everybody understands that importance. And upright posture really applies, this instruction applies whether you're comfortable sitting on the floor or not. So here, particularly with this retreat, we understand deeply that not everybody can sit cross-legged on the floor. We can't, for various reasons. So we sit on stools, and we offer these stools for people to use to get some physical relief of leg pain, hip pain, knee pain, ankle pain that can come with sitting cross-legged. We have said, please don't bring chairs in here for a very specific reason. Because what chairs do is they are conducive to that kind of postural collapse that's not helpful in meditation. They're conducive to just kind of sitting back, having that unnatural curvature in the spine that compresses the lungs, compresses the heart. And these stools are really wonderful because, for one thing, the seat is flat, unlike the chairs. It doesn't have a scoop, a depression. And if you take one of these little mats and you fold it in thirds and put the double side on the back, it actually tilts the hips just a little bit forward. You don't want too much, or that provides the stiff, arched back. But just a little bit forward so that it allows the spine to naturally align. And it's actually very, very comfortable. The back holds itself up. And of course, there's no temptation to lean back. And we've noticed with a certain amount of amusement, actually, how all the stools are kind of lining up against the back wall there. And I just want to give a gentle encouragement to those of you who have put your stools along the back wall so you can lean against the wall, to try something different, to sit without leaning back against the wall, to find that natural middle path where the spine holds itself up and the bones support the body naturally. And I know some of you are saying to yourselves, but what about my injury, my scoliosis, my whatever? Play with this, even if this is you. I've got pretty interesting scoliosis myself. And I find the stool just very, very useful for sitting. I much prefer it to sitting in a chair. So play with this. And understand that an upright posture is very like this, a natural, relaxed, upright posture. It's really conducive to deep physical relaxation. So that's relaxing the body. Then, of course, relaxing the mind. And this is equally, if not even more, important in the practice. It's important to understand that mental relaxation doesn't mean zoning out. It also doesn't mean freedom to just let the mind do whatever it wants. So ultimately, what do we mean when we say relaxing the mind? So if we think of what it looks like to have mental relaxation, What often comes to mind is being on vacation, maybe being at the beach, or being at home on a weekend morning when nothing is pulling at us. We have no commitments, no time pressure. There's just ease. This ease, this relaxation of mind, requires that a number of things come together. First and foremost, it really requires that we be safe and at ease. We've been chanting in the Metta Sutta. In the very beginning, it says, before it talks about radiating loving kindness to the various sizes and kinds of beings, it talks about wishing in gladness and in safety. Another translation of that line is being secure and at ease. So there are a couple of layers of this. First is a sense of physical safety and physical comfort. And the commentarial texts speak quite a bit about the supportive conditions for the development of the meditative faculties and the meditative mental powers, the mental faculties. And they prominently mention the importance of suitable places, suitable conditions. So this center and the care that has gone into creating suitable conditions for your practice are actually a really important part of mental relaxation, of creating that mental relaxation. Sayadaw really wants us all to be comfortable, to feel at home. And he's made an amazing, amazing amount of effort to accommodate our relatively high maintenance needs. Aria was mentioning the other day about mattresses, and there's so many levels of this, the hot water, the mattresses, the food we get, which is quite amazing. I mean, if you saw the basic food that Myanmar yogis get, it's nothing like what we're getting. We're getting a lot of different food. We get the bread in the morning because Sayadaw knows Westerners like bread. We get fruit at breakfast time because Sayadaw knows Westerners like fruit at breakfast time. So all that effort is in the service of allowing us to feel at ease. And the fact that this center is far away from the city, it's relatively quiet, the serene and beautiful surroundings are very conducive for feeling at ease. So the second condition that's very important in supporting this is actually not about physical surroundings, but it's our feeling of safety with each other, our communal feeling of safety. This is an actual deeper aspect of safety that comes from being able to relax around each other to feel safe. Knowing that there isn't even any energetic risk or ripples even. This is why in Burma, meditation halls are often completely gender segregated so that women are only sitting in one hall and men only in another. This is a small center, so we separate the hall in two. And what's interesting is what we do is we separate it down the middle like this, so that men sit on one side, women on the other. Mostly in Burma, the men would be sitting in front of the women. But what this is for is to create a sense of safety and ease. Now, everybody knows nobody here will be harming anyone. But there's a feeling of being amongst similar beings that's very relaxing. And I know when I sit and I'm beginning to get quite deep in practice, I get very sensitive to having to sit next to men. So if I'm in the West, I try to find a place far away from, you know, where there's a corner and I know I'll just be surrounded by women. It's very relaxing. And I know for men as well. So we arrange things so that men live on one side, women on the other. This causes a lot of relaxation and ease. And then there are the precepts that we chant every day before the talk. And these precepts are a profound place of safety. They're the foundation of the practice and the very means by which we all are able to coexist here harmoniously. And there are various levels of holding the precepts. And the more refined, the more we work with them in a refined way, the more safety we are creating for ourselves and for each other. So, for example, the first precept, I undertake the precept to refrain from killing living beings. Of course, we all know that nobody here is going to be, you know, murdering anybody else. But mosquitoes, flies, you know, we undertake the precept to refrain from harming any living being. This creates this huge field of safety here at the center for everyone, without exception. People are no more important than mosquitoes when we hold the precept in this way. Likewise, for example, the second precept, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. And when speaking of communal harmony, this is incredibly relaxation-inducing. So, for example, we don't have them here, but when they're shared, like, communal bathrooms, you can leave your soap there and know that somebody isn't just going to pick it up and use it. You can leave your water bottle outside the hall and know it will be there when you come out. You don't have to be vigilant about yourself and about your surroundings. And so each of the precepts, also the third precept about sexual activity, of course, the precept about speech, which in this context means noble silence, and the precept about alcohol and drugs, each of these creates a huge field of safety and ease for everybody, for yourself and for each other. Often in the West, these precepts are given lip service. Maybe people take the eight precepts, maybe they don't. Maybe people talk about the precepts in some detail at the beginning of a retreat, but usually they don't. But to understand this safety that these precepts provide and the physical and mental ease they provide, is the foundation of a quiet mind. And a quiet mind is the foundation of onward leading practice. So we're not vigilant as a result about what others are doing, and we're not feeling remorse internally for having done something that harms other people. So the precepts are incredibly important. So in terms of creating ease and safety, there's the external environment, there are the precepts, and then there are a whole suite of attitudes that are conducive to creating that sense of safety and ease. Creating that mental relaxation that's so important for the practice. We're here to develop and cultivate loving kindness. We are doing something. You know, we don't just sit back and have it magically arrive. We have to do the practice. But to practice in an onward leading way, it's important to understand a few things about what we can do and what we can't do. Because while we are doing something, the most helpful attitudes for the practice are attitudes of quietude and no pressure, of a sort of non-doing and non-interference. And there are a couple of aspects to this that I want to highlight. First, in our kind of overt external behavior, in the Metta Sutta at the beginning, it says, one should be unburdened with duties. Or another translation says, not doing too much. So here it can be very helpful to know what this really means is not getting uselessly busy. So reflecting in your general activities and being careful about how you lose the thread of the practice, or if you lose the thread of the practice in doing things that really aren't necessary or useful. Like cleaning your kuti for the 10th time today, or getting that third cup of tea, or maybe there's some obsessive body care that's going on. Everybody has their own flavor of the kind of busyness that happens on a retreat that's not completely necessary. And as an aid to guiding the mind away from busyness, it's very helpful to slow down a little bit. As we've said in the metta practice, it's not necessary to go super slow as we do in the vipassana practice. But slowing down to a certain extent is very, very useful. As an aid to really noticing, are we buzzing around like a little bee? Bzzz, doing a lot of things, going here and there. Just relaxing into a strolling pace. And external busyness is also what Saito was mentioning today at lunchtime when he was talking about how It's important to be quiet when we're eating, to be quiet when we're walking. This is what he was referring to, and it's actually very useful, because when we have to be quiet like this, we're not doing things automatically, and it slows everything down. And that slowness in and of itself is relaxing. So be aware if you're busy, and dial it back a little bit. Be aware if you're moving quickly, and try to dial that back a little bit. We come into retreat from very noisy, busy, incredibly kind of fast-paced lives. So at first, this takes a little bit of effort. But believe me, when you go back out after being here in a couple of weeks, it's going to take effort to speed up to try to do that again. And you may decide you don't want to live that way anymore. This deep relaxation is also deeply healing. So there's the attitude of not being busy. That's very, very useful. And then internally, in terms of how we practice, this is where it gets really, really important. This is why I mentioned no pressure and non-interference. Because first of all, being busy in the practice is not an attitude of relaxation and ease. So if you're constantly kind of tweaking the practice, adjusting, going through your meditative toolbox, fixing, noticing what's happening and going, oh, I need a little more of this and I need a little more of that, and maybe if I do this and maybe if I do that. And if that there's a constancy of inner commentary, of judging and assessing the practice. A little of that can be useful, but it can get overwhelming. It can get all the time. Trying to get the practice to be perfect. That's not really possible because we're human beings. So the best instruction is to really just keep it simple. This is an incredible and very simple practice. It's not at all complicated. It just means to put your body here on the cushion or out on the porch in walking meditation and incline the mind to cultivation of loving kindness as continuously as you can. Just repeating that phrase over and over again. Connecting with the meaning, connecting with the person as much as you can. Whether it seems mechanical or not, whether you feel anything or not, whether you're distracted or not, whether your mind is pure or not, just simply moment to moment to moment. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. May my respected person be well, happy, and peaceful. May my respected person be well, happy, and peaceful. So that's not very hard to do. It's not very complicated. But that continuity is really important. So that's the main thing, is just exerting enough energy to continually incline the mind in that direction. The second aspect of non-interference is actually more subtle. And that's not attempting to create the loving kindness. Fortunately, we're not here to do that, because we can't create loving kindness. We just create the conditions for it to arise naturally. Through that simple repetition of the phrase and through that repeated connection with the phrase and with the person, seeing the goodness in the person, inclining, repeating the phrase over and over and over again, the nature of a mind that's free of greed, hatred, and delusion is, by definition, a mind that has loving kindness in it. So this practice is very much a training. So we're training ourselves to have the habit of going in that direction, as opposed to going towards greed, hatred, and delusion. And we're purifying the mind. We're cleaning up our act internally. And it's that simple repetition that does it. The metta comes by itself. And I know many of you have already reported this, people who have been here for the first half. Often people have said in their interviews, wow, it was such a surprise. I was just sitting there and boom, the metta was suddenly flowing. I couldn't do that. I don't know what happened. Yeah. Our little egos can't create metta. That's too much energy. That's force. That never creates metta. That just creates frustration. So to just settle back into the practice of repeating the phrase and connecting, no matter what, this is enough. That's all that's needed. And that actually, just knowing that, can be incredibly relaxing. It's like, okay, good. I don't have to create anything here. Nor, just as we don't have to create the loving kindness, nor do we have to send it. This is a kind of a misunderstanding that a lot of people have. And it's not that we have to push it out or give it to somebody or, you know, kind of pump it out of the heart. And it can be really easy to exert way too much energy in trying to do this. The thing about metta, though, is that it's like light in darkness. When you turn on a light in a dark room, that light bulb doesn't send light out. It's just there. It lights up the whole room. Or like a lighthouse, you know, in the darkness. That beam of light that goes around at a lighthouse is like metta. The light shines in the dark, just as metta radiates by itself. And again, all that we need is that gentle inclining, that constancy of a gentle guiding the heart away from greed, away from hatred, away from delusion. repeating the phrase, connecting with the meaning, connecting with the image or the felt sense of the person. And the image I really like, another metaphor I really like, is like planting seeds. And I used to be a gardener, so this metaphor really works for me. And because it's so natural, we put seeds in the ground, and we create the conditions, the soil, the water, the fertilizer, whatever we put in the soil, the weeding. We create the conditions for the plants to grow and thrive. And that happens in its own sweet time. It's not an instant thing. So when we plant metta seeds, it's the same as planting carrot seeds. You know, the carrot plants may come up, but if you start pulling them up to see if the roots have grown, you don't get any carrots. So when you plant a garden, the seeds come up. When they come up, you don't have to grow them. They grow themselves. And if conditions are right, they grow kind of as a natural reflection of what that seed is. And it's just like that with loving kindness. And all of this is basically another way of articulating classic right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. That's a talk in itself, and I'm not going to go into any detail. But basically, there are four components to right effort. There's the effort to restrain whatever unwholesome mind states are already there. So in other words, not feeding any unwholesome mind states that have arisen. There's the effort to abandon unwholesome mind states. There's the effort to develop wholesome mind states that are not yet there. And then there's the effort to maintain those wholesome mind states. So, cultivating the wholesome, refraining from any kind of feeding or acting out the unwholesome. This is really what we are doing when we do the metta practice. We're constantly inclining to the wholesome. We're constantly starving the unwholesome. And this is a deep and abiding source of ease and happiness. And it's a feedback loop. We need the ease and happiness in order to practice, but it feeds more ease and more happiness. This is what we speak of when we speak of momentum in the practice. It's that positive feedback loop. And it's just the most beautiful thing. And if you've just arrived, or maybe if you've been here for a while, and if you have any doubts about this practice, this is particularly common for those of us who've just done Vipassana and are introduced to the loving kindness. And it feels a little forced. It feels like a lot of activity. We can't just rest back in what is. We have to cultivate this phrase. We have to connect with the meaning. We have to continually repeat it. If this feels unfamiliar to you, we understand. I have to say, in my own practice, and I was so attached to the Vipassana practice, and I really loved it. Still do. But when I first had to do a long metta retreat, it wasn't voluntary. And I hated it. I really, really didn't like it. I thought it was the stupidest thing on the planet. Fortunately, minds change. I have completely the opposite opinion of it now. And it's the best thing in the world. Because this positive feedback loop that happens with the metta practice leads to a deep kind of ease and relaxation around all conditioned phenomena, internally and externally. And this only supports the Vipassana practice in the deepest possible way. So if you're having any of these doubts because the practice is unfamiliar, because maybe it seems forced, please, as much as you can, put them aside. Just try this as an experiment for a couple of weeks. Try it wholeheartedly. And see for yourself, ehi pasiko. Come and see. And see what you think in a couple of weeks. So the final kind of attitude that I want to talk about is this acceptance that metta requires and that metta brings. All of these aspects of right effort ask that we know and recognize wholesome and unwholesome mind states when they arise. And in order to do this, we have to be willing to let them in the first place. To admit to ourselves that there are unwholesome mind states. To see ourselves clearly. To accept what is arising. Internally with ourselves, externally with other people. Just as we are. Metta bhavana, the cultivation of loving kindness, is cultivating this habit of benevolence, of friendliness, of well-wishing, starting right here with ourselves and moving out to others, regardless of what we want to change in ourselves and in other people. Again, that change, you know, changes happen when they happen. We can't force them, just like we can't create metta. And there's a really lovely quotation from Suzuki Roshi that I really like, but because it expresses the paradox of all of this. Each of you is perfect the way you are. And you can use a little improvement. So we accept with an attitude of it being okay and understand, yeah, okay, there are these unwholesome mind states. And when we're as deeply committed to this practice and to the cultivation of wisdom and compassion, as all of you are. I mean, it takes a lot of commitment to come this far to practice and to spend this much time in the practice. So when we're as deeply committed to this as we are, that very commitment can easily slide into denying the truth about what we're feeling and how we are in the world. we're afraid if these unwholesome mind states arise, oh my goodness, I'm not being, you know, dharmic enough or spiritual enough, or I must not be practicing right, or... But this is just our nature as human beings. We're not enlightened yet, so stuff happens. So no matter what comes up, the metta practice is not meant to be used as a way of avoiding unpleasant experiences. So no matter what comes up, and in the practice, it's very natural that whatever is not loving kindness will emerge to be seen. When this stuff comes up, the practice is simply to acknowledge that and let it be in the background and to continue this cultivation of loving kindness. So even if you are full of resistance or boredom or self-judgment or doubt or greed or irritation or whatever it is, restlessness, sleepiness, the practice is just to acknowledge that with kindness, accept that there it is, and continue as best you can to cultivate the loving kindness. There's no need to do anything about any of it, to understand it, to investigate it. That's the role of vipassana, and that's not what we do here. In the metta practice, it's really enough to acknowledge that it's there and then to gently incline the mind to wholesomeness. Oh, restlessness. May I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. And when there are a lot of difficulties, and sometimes it can be this way, there's a way that the very practice of loving kindness can feel very tender. It can feel like a bigger embrace that holds everything. And I say this often to myself, well, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway, no matter what is coming up. And in this respect, in terms of acceptance, in terms of allowing things to be as they are, don't feel you need to rush through this sequence of categories. If you find moving on to another category brings a lot of difficulty, then trust yourself to stay where it's easier, to keep cultivating the loving kindness until it's strong and established. Stay where it's easy until you have a momentum of the practice to go on to the next category. And that's always the instruction. Stay where it's easy. Go back to where it's easy if you need to. Because, as I said, things will come up. It may get quite difficult. It doesn't for everybody, but for some people, that sometimes in the practice, for all of us, we hit these walls of challenge. But this practice is really about persistent inclination away from all our kind of unwholesome, habitual mind states. These places of fake kind of safety, anxiety, ill will, judgment, whatever it is. And opening the heart to whatever obstructions there are to the loving kindness and the purification of these. It takes a ton of courage, really a lot of courage and persistence, to go against the stream of old habits and of kind of psychological addictions. Addictions to the way we are, the way we habitually relate to the world and to each other and to ourselves. But it can be done. That's the most beautiful thing about this practice. It's not just available to the Buddhas of the world. Each of us can succeed in this for our own happiness and for the well-being and benefit of everybody around us. Last year, there was a lovely surprise TED Talk that Pope Francis gave. He didn't give it in person. He gave it with a video link. And it was just the most kind of beautiful articulation of a lot of what we talk about when we talk about loving kindness. And I want to close today with a quote from that talk that really speaks to me. He said, "Tenderness is the path of choice for the strongest, most courageous men and women. Tenderness is not weakness. It's fortitude. It's the path of solidarity and the path of humility." So may we all find that ease and relaxation that supports and creates a beautiful field of loving kindness. And may we all walk this path of tenderness to its very end for the welfare and benefit of all living beings. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.